Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. How do people solve impossible problems? Extending our senses by going beyond them, meet the next greatest generation. The TED Radio Hour is a journey through fascinating ideas, astonishing inventions, fresh approaches to old problems, and new ways to think and create. Find the TED Radio Hour on iTunes under podcasts. And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, we go small at the movies. We talk about films for kids and some of our favorites, right up to Disney's current hit, Big Hero 6. And in honor of Thanksgiving, we'll consider a few leftovers. In this case, the mysteries of outtakes and other stuff that's often left behind when the cultural turkey is cooked. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And with us this week, we have a brand new person to the Pop Culture Happy Hour family. It's incredibly exciting. Guy Raz, what do you do at NPR?
I host the TED Radio Hour.
I was telling Guy the other day, if I'm listening to the radio on the weekend and I'm not 100% sure what time it is or where we are in the rotation of weekend shows, and I hear something that is interesting that I cannot immediately identify which show it is.
It's This American Life?
It's TED.
Oh.
It's pretty much always TED.
Thank you.
So we're so glad Guy was able to be with us this week. And when we spoke to Guy about coming on the show, he sort of was telling us a little bit about his pop culture situation.
Yeah.
Do you want to reveal that to the people, sir?
Well, I feel really, honored on so many levels to be on the show, probably most notably because for the past 6 years, I've been in a kind of a pop culture black hole.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So 6 years ago, my oldest son was born.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm sleep deprived. And then we've got another one. He's three. And
these kids are adorable, by the way.
And
really cute.
And so, in recent years, there's been kids movies and kids music. But man, it's been a black hole. So I'm ready to jump right out of that black hole back into the world of pop culture.
Right. Someday.
Right here. Right now.
Oh, I see. So you want to know whether Game of Thrones is okay for the kids.
Yeah, exactly.
Nope.
It's not.
I can't believe we've gone this far into the show without anyone acknowledging my grace and magnanimity in allowing another dad on this show.
Yeah.
It's true.
This is the first time I have allowed... You know how many vanquished dads have tried to get on this show only to be denied by me?
He doesn't share very well.
No, I don't.
And yet here you are anyway. But at the same time, we didn't want to make it too hard on Guy's first time out and force him into completely new areas of pop culture after
today's
6 years
away. Diapers. Pull-ups.
Diaper commercials. So we did want to talk about kids' movies. Now, Guy, you saw Big Hero 6,
yes,
right?
Yes, Big Hero 6, yeah.
Yeah, it took the kids?
Took my older son.
Took your older son.
My five-and-a-half-year-old. Three is young for that movie.
Does your three-year-old do movies at all?
Yeah, I'll get to that. We took him to Book of Life.
Okay.
Yeah, and he's seen Mr. Peabody, but we'll get to that.
Yeah. Okay. But you took the older
five and a half year old. We went to Big Hero 6. I would say about 15 or 20 minutes into the film, I was sort of having second thoughts about whether it was age appropriate because,
mm-hmm.
There is a traumatic thing that happens pretty early on in the film. He was sitting next to me in the movie theater, and I would say, about 20 minutes in, he moved from his seat onto my lap and watched the rest of the movie in my lap, and sometimes he buried his face into my shoulder.
Uh-huh.
But generally, he was okay with it, and when it was over, he loved it. He was like thumbs up, jumping up and down. He was talking about it, and
that's how Steven was.
I was just gonna say I was literally the exact same way, probably on about the same level,
right?
Yeah.
Same comprehension level.
Yeah.
So he dug it.
He absolutely loved it. I mean, the story is really interesting. The characters are awesome. It moves quickly. It has all those great elements that you want from any kind of animated film, really.
Yeah.
The character is like, Hero is a sort of kind of like a, he's really smart, but he's kind of like a wimpy kid, and he becomes a superhero.
Right. And we should say, the basic premise of the movie is that Hero, who is a young teenager, is kind of a super genius and he builds robots and things like that. As kids in movies like this often do, this is sort of classic Disney, right? You wind up kind of having to go out on your own and find a new tribe, and he hooks up with a bunch of friends who are eventually going to turn into the Big Hero 6, who I didn't even know they were Marvel characters.
Yeah,
oh, certainly they are, yeah.
Are they minor Marvel characters?
Really
sort of?
Minor, really obscure.
Yeah.
It was a comic in 1998. It wasn't that great, but this is the Guardians of the Galaxy approach here, where Disney buys Marvel, says, what do we have here? And kind of goes through their back catalog and finds this one. Originally, it wasn't a particularly great comic. I mean, it was two white guys saying, what would a Japanese super team be like?
Yeah.
And so they have a character who is like Super Samurai, and they have a boy with a giant robot.
And a wasabi.
To be fair, that's kind of comics. I mean, when Marvel came up with a Canadian super team, there was a guy named Sasquatch and a guy named Wolverine and a person named Aurora and a guy named Puck. As in hockey. I thought they were going to really commit to it and do poutine and politeness and good improv, but they didn't. But what Disney did was took that idea and Disneyfied the hell out of it. I mean, they diversified it, which is great. Anytime, you know, what's on the screen looks more like the audience, that's a good thing. And they also brought to the table actors like Scott Adsit and T.J. Miller. Yeah. T.J. Miller is a very good comedian, a very funny guy. And at some point in the film, he says, science, yeah, which is just a very T.J. Miller kind of thing to do. But they're getting the attention. I want to shine some light on Ryan Potter, who is a 19-year-old kid who plays Hero. All of the emotional heft to this film is on this kid's shoulders, and he knocks it out of the park.
Yeah,
he's great.
I think he's great. The other thing about the comic that I want to mention before we go too far is that kind of the main attraction of the movie, and certainly the best publicized part of the movie, is the robot, Baymax.
Yeah.
Kind of a big walking balloon. Like if you were a...
He's like Babenda meets C-3PO, like the Michelin Man. And
right. Like if you took one of the balloons from the Macy's Day Parade and turned it into a robot... And in the comics, it's totally different. In the comics, it's just a big robot, I think.
Yep.
And so the invention of that robot is a big part of the
bringing
to life of this movie.
And that robot has been designed and is introduced in the movie. It is a nurturing robot. It is a healthcare-providing robot that this kid's brother has invented. And the robot kind of turns into somewhat of a guardian for this kid and obviously is a stand-in for the brother. You said they Disneyfied the hell of it. I mean, it is very much a mashup of a Marvel superhero origin story and a Pixar movie.
Yeah.
It's a Disney movie, but it really feels Pixar.
In its
gigantic throbbing heart. You have a standard Disney trauma that occurs in the first act, but it's very much going almost for an up-level, tear-jerking quality at times in this movie. For me, it absolutely worked to a degree I found almost stunning. How much I laughed during this movie, how much I blubbered like the big sack of tears that I am. And I went to this movie with my kids and with Linda. And Linda, you will testify. I mean, I just sat there and at the end of the movie, just my face streaked with tears. Yeah. I mean, it totally worked on me, even though there are elements of this movie, elements of the storytelling, particularly in the superhero plot of this movie, that are just boilerplate. You know exactly where the actual plot of this movie is going.
Yeah.
And yet it is wonderfully executed.
You know what's crazy about this movie to me is that the guy who made the Winnie the Pooh movie a couple years back, he was tasked with finding a Marvel movie, right? Because this is the first Disney Marvel movie that they did together.
Yeah.
And they only started working on it 2 years ago.
That's amazing.
Which is incredible.
Take a long time,
and
usually.
It's really like Disney's homage to Japanese animation.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And it reminded me a little bit of that film, Kiki's Delivery Service.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this kind of idealized San Francisco, Tokyo. There's sort of a dystopian quality to downtown, but the neighborhood of San Francisco,
right,
the sort of mashup of the cities, this kind of perfect idealized.
Yeah, I don't know if I would call it dystopian. I mean, it's...
But the bot stuff is sort of... Yeah. There's definitely an underworld-y kind of
The bots
of
haven't
quality.
Yet overthrown the
Not yet, right, yeah.
No, that's true. You mentioned Pixar, and there is a lot of... They're cross-pollinating the kind of Walt Disney Studios stuff and the Pixar stuff quite a bit.
Right.
I mean, John Lasseter, who did a bunch of the stuff with the Pixar movies, is sort of a producer on, like, all the Disney movies now and is kind of a finger in all of this stuff. One of the things that I noticed that I mentioned to Stephen yesterday is that the two guys who are the credited directors on this movie were part of the writing team for The Emperor's New Groove, which Stephen was just talking about a couple weeks ago that he really, really loved.
Yep.
You tend to see these creators kind of go in and out and do bunches of different stuff. But the thing that makes me so pleased about this is that for a while, you know, Glenn used the word Disney-fied. And for a long time when we were growing up, the idea of Disney was that it was very kind of emotionally undeveloped and very much on the surface.
Yeah.
And then starting with The Little Mermaid, they did the musicals, and they kind of had this reputation for doing these very, at least they were really fun, joyful musicals. But it's really only been in the last couple of years with some of these movies that have kind of started to, like Steven said, bring in some of that like Pixar-y idea of a more complex emotional palette that I think is carried through in this movie.
And also stronger female characters. Frozen was really like a watershed, right? Because you had these strong female characters, and ultimately one sister saves the other sister.
Right.
And in this character, you have, you know, strong female superheroes as well. And it really, you mentioned The Little Mermaid, and I mean that, you know, talk about, you know, the damsel in distress being rescued by the man above the sea.
Mm-hmm.
And so it sort of really shows how far Disney's come and how they are also able to make these films that are really interesting, and not just interesting for my 5.5-year-old, but for a grown-up sitting with him.
Absolutely. And, you know, but you had mentioned to us, Guy, that you also had seen another movie with your kids that you liked a lot.
Yes, The Book of Life, which is also another really, really interesting film. It's this beautifully animated film, and it, of course, takes place against a backdrop of Dia de los Muertos.
Okay.
So all the characters have this Dia de los Muertos aesthetic, and these death masks, and they're drawn as wooden puppets, like Pinocchio-style puppets.
Oh, interesting.
It takes place in Mexico, and it's this really wonderful story. It's a love story, ultimately about perseverance and about fighting for what you believe in.
Story checks out, kids movie
wise. Exactly.
I wanted actually to go see it, but it came and went so quickly. It was out of theaters in a week or two, it seemed like.
It's a very competitive world, the kids movie world.
Yeah. And I should also offer up this caveat, which is there was a 21-minute gap in the film when I saw it, and that was because my 3.5-year-old wanted to leave the theater and race up and down the corridor outside. So I missed 21 minutes
so
of
you
it.
You took your 3.5-year-old out to do that.
Yeah, my 5-year-old was watching it. He wanted to race up and down the corridor and scream at the top of his lungs.
And you didn't allow that in the theater while
not
I was
in
there.
The theater.
Wow.
No, we went outside.
Why do I never go to movies with you?
You're a good citizen. It's interesting because if you saw this within the last couple of weeks, that means it's been competing with Big Hero 6.
Right.
And I think my experience of kids' movies has been they can be gigantic hits. I mean, Big Hero 6 did more business on the weekend that it opened than Interstellar by a little tiny bit, as I recall. So Big Hero 6 is massively successful. It's hard to get like two to go at the same time.
Well, I mean, as I've mentioned on the show, you know, a few years ago, a friend of mine was one of the screenwriters on Turbo, the race car driving snail movie. And that movie just got pummeled because it came out like 2 weeks after Despicable Me 2. And they didn't know at the time when they scheduled its release date in mid-July that it was just going to get steamrolled by the only kids' movie that can be a hit at one time.
Right, but I think there's an X factor here, too. I mean, I think the best animated films, the best kids' films, Finding Nemo, Toy Story, The Incredibles, Iron Giant, they come at you with a very distinctive, idiosyncratic, I don't want to use the word auteur when it comes to animated films because
I mean,
film is a collaborative medium, and if that's true for film, animated film, 100
times.
Because if you sat through Big Hero 6 and you sat through the credits, you got not only every person who did any coding on that film, Disney's A Turn Apart is listed in the credits.
Yeah, I've been reading a book called Creativity Inc., which is by one of the guys who works at Pixar, one of the executives.
Right.
And yes,
exactly.
Absolutely true.
I think there's a quality to some kids' entertainment, however, where I call it the talk to the handishness of it. It's the difference between Disney, which when it's working well, achieves a kind of timelessness, and the Disney Channel, which is attempting to grasp the moment with white knuckles. So the Disney Channel is where a lot of like precocious tweens have this irony that they haven't really earned and they don't know how to employ, and that's where you get a lot of LOL, talk to the hand. Well, not talk to the hand anymore. Let's hope.
Old man Wells is still upset about talk to the hand.
Don't go there. OMG. All that stuff. It manifests as this fake surfacey thing. Like you da ant. We talked about in the DreamWorks film. DreamWorks is more guilty of this, what I'm talking about, this tone than Pixar is. And there are moments in Big Hero 6, for example, the moments where we meet the team in that lab where everybody comes along and they have the little quirk. That moment straddles the line between Disney and Disney Channel for me.
Huh.
And that's why I was puzzled why I liked this film, didn't love it. Because really, the message it teaches is the classic superhero lesson, which is right up my street, which is that revenge is hollow and selfish and heroes do something different. That is, I totally buy that, but I just found myself less moved. Now, I did see it first thing on a Sunday morning with like me, two other guys and two kids in the entire theater, empty theater. So I didn't really kind of feel like this collective thing, but it didn't hit me.
Yeah, see, the thing that I get out of that is don't watch the Disney Channel, but Disney Junior.
Oh, okay.
Much better. Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Right. See, he knows all about this.
I would imagine
he knows the. So if you were gonna advise us about television, do your kids watch a lot of kids TV that you?
Yeah,
on check
the
week.
So we do the weekend thing where Friday night and Saturday night they get to watch some TV. Lately we've been watching this original series from Amazon.
Oh, and
everyone talks about Transparent and Alpha House, right? But nobody is talking about Creative Galaxy. It's an original Amazon kids show, and it's basically this little alien, and his name is Artie, because he's an artist,
and he
travels through the galaxy. And the premise of the show is that it begins with a problem, like, you know, he doesn't want to take a bath. So he has to go through the galaxy and collect all these art supplies.
As one does, to
solve the problem. And once he gathers all his art supplies, he lands on a planet and he starts to use them. And then it cuts away to real kids doing that art project.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and my kids love it. Mm. I mean, both my 5-year-old and my 3-year-old absolutely love it. They've seen almost every episode. I think they did 13 episodes, and they're going to do another season, I believe, next year.
I knew that Amazon had some kids stuff, but I haven't seen any of it.
They have another one called Tumble Leaf, which we haven't gotten into yet, but we will. It's a stop motion. It looks really cool.
Is it true, you people with kids, is it true that whatever you show them, you have to gird yourself to see it millions and millions and millions of times? I mean, that's certainly true with books. Kids want to read and hear the same books over and again. I would imagine, I've heard it's true with Frozen among certain households. Is that something you guys have to contend with?
I know how it works in one of these households.
Yeah, I mean, I think to a certain extent that's true, and I've been very fortunate that part of it is that the stuff I have chosen to share with my kids tends to be the stuff that I have at some point or another responded to. And I've been very fortunate that they've never really hooked terribly hard into something that I found objectionable. You know, their mom and I were very careful never to expose them to Barney, for example. You know, we knew that that we could avoid a lot of cloying stuff, and it helps that there's so much adult-friendly children's programming. We've been in a golden age of that for years. SpongeBob's a really fun show.
It's a great show. It's a great show.
It's a clever and very... They're just like little Easter eggs in the script that keep parents, you know, hooked along.
But even things like Sesame Street, which, you know, my kids are sort of growing out of it. But we, you know, Saturday morning, they sort of jump into our bed and then turn on the TV, and that's on PBS. And, you know, just like this weekend, I was sort of waking up as they were watching it, and there was Ice Cube on Sesame Street.
Yeah.
I thought, there's Ice Cube on Sesame Street. You know, OK Go does a video.
Sure.
For, and the kids recognize them from the NPR video that they did.
Oh,
so,
sure.
Yeah. So,
I see.
Even Sesame Street's really, really cool. They do these parodies of movies. Mm-hmm. They did a wonderful, amazing parody of Homeland with Rhodey.
Mm.
It was a bunch of sheep. It was a bunch of sheep. He was a wolf in sheep's clothing. Rhodey.
Wow.
Yeah, it was great.
Yeah. The last time I was watching, you know, Sesame Street, and admittedly, you know, my kids are 13 and 10, so we're a few years removed from it. I mean, really, the closest person in the household to that emotional age is me.
Yeah.
But for me, it was always like Cookie Monster, yay, Elmo, just the scourge of my existence.
But even Elmo lately has a slightly darker edge to him. Yeah. There's something a little bit sharper about
Elmo's
Elmo.
Darker.
All right,
yeah.
So round the table, like, favorite piece of children's oriented entertainment.
I really do love those Disney musicals. I love Beauty and the Beast.
Oh, God, yeah.
I think that run of movies is...
Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin.
Really holds up. I mean, look, you have to throw out some of the pop songs. Like, you have to throw out some of the songs in The Lion King and stuff like that. You have to throw out the Jack Nicholson stuff in Aladdin. Yeah. You have to kind of take the...
I always imagine that there's a gay hairdresser routine in Aladdin. I'm not sure is.
I'm sure there is something
for like
that...
3 milliseconds, I think there is.
Yeah. You have to throw out a certain amount of stuff that is exactly what Glenn was talking about. It's that
Aladdin
of
has more of that than most.
Aladdin does because of the Robin Williams performance, which I love, but it has a lot of that Yuda Ant Glenn is talking about.
Is always going to... So I was going to stand in for that.
But I love those. I love those musicals. How about you, Glenn?
I wrote 2 books, one about Superman, one about Batman. So, I mean, that kind of covers it. But in terms of sharing with kids, I love sharing Miyazaki films with kids because I need to watch it too. And the first time as an adult in a Western culture that you see a Miyazaki film, you have no idea what's going to happen.
Like, for example,
Spirited Away, My Neighbor Totoro, Princess Mononoke, Howl's Moving Castle, Ponyo, Nausicaa in the Valley of the Wind, Castle in the Sky. These films
Kiki's Delivery Service, of course.
These films come from the mind of one weird old dude, and they don't lay over the familiar infrastructure of good versus evil fairy tale stuff that we have. So it's coming from a completely different culture, so you don't know what's going to happen. The kid doesn't know what's going to happen, so you're kind of experiencing it together. So any Miyazaki film is so gorgeous and wonderful and weird.
The one that I watched very recently with the kids, only for like the umpty kazillionth time, but Big Hero 6 really reminded me of it, is Iron Giant.
Right.
I've been surprised talking to people in the office today about how much I loved Big Hero 6, that several of my coworkers, including ones with little kids, did not know The Iron Giant or knew of it but hadn't seen it. God, people, if you have not seen this wonderful, beautiful, funny and fun but also tear-jerking movie, I really highly recommend it. It's Brad Bird, who later directed The Incredibles and Ratatouille and has never done anything bad in his whole life, as near as I can tell, even in his personal life. I'm just going to assume. The Iron Giant is a wonderful, wonderful film, and Big Hero 6 mirrors it in a lot of ways.
It does.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite?
I'm going to give like a very NPR answer, because I love
Quinoa, movie.
I love that one. That's my favorite one. I love shows that really focus on curiosity, where the characters are curious and where the kids, when they watch it, they can sort of see where that character is going and how they're discovering things along the way. So things like Super Why, it's a great show. It's about kids and their readers, and they have to solve a puzzle. They have to solve a problem, and they have to read to get there. It's great. But we also love the Peanuts gang.
Sure.
I mean, the Peanuts gang is part of it is this kind of idealized, you know, and very old-fashioned view of America, and sometimes troubling view of America. But there are things about it that I really love. We got this whole set of the Peanuts history of America or something like that. Oh. My 5.5-year-old, he went through all of them, you know, the Constitution and Henry Ford and, you know, different stories about American history. And I don't know, there was something about it that really, it reminded me of like civics class in junior high.
They're very earnest in a good way.
And they're characters that represent the entire spectrum of emotions. I mean, there's empathy and perseverance, and there's curiosity, and there's cruelty. And I don't know, there's something about that whole world that he created that I really love.
Yeah.
Well, that's awesome.
Pigpen would be Howard Hughes.
I would be very curious to hear what folks have to say to us. So come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/PCHH. We're going to take a very quick break. And when we come back, it's outtakes, it's mistakes, it's extra stuff, it's Thanksgiving leftovers. So stick around.
A quick shout out to thank our sponsor, Emma. These guys offer tools for email marketing. With Emma, you can create sophisticated automated email campaigns and deliver targeted messages to your audience. The interface is super intuitive, so your team can create great-looking emails in a drag-and-drop editor and track the results easily using an interactive click map that shows where people are clicking in your email. Emma's great for marketing teams or agencies who want to upgrade from the more DIY services, but don't want the complexity and expense of an enterprise system. Give them a try at myemma.com.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Now, as you are hearing this show is coming to you the day after Thanksgiving. We did want to give a little bit of a nod to the holiday, and we thought, turkeys? No. Side dishes? We did side dishes once, believe it or not. Hmm. There is an old Pop Culture Happy Hour about pop culture side dishes.
We are just running out of material right now.
You know, pies? No. But then we thought, leftovers. And we started to think, what would be pop culture leftovers? And we started to think about outtakes. And then we thought, well, you know, Guy Raz is going to be in the studio with us. Mm. And we thought, I bet he knows a little bit more about real radio, you know, screw-ups than we do. So I wanted to ask you, what would we find in the safe?
Oh, man. So, of course, a lot of what we do on NPR is not live, right? From our news programs to my program, we do sort of either record them just beforehand or parts of them are recorded and parts of them are live. So, you know, bloopers happen, like when you watch the, you know, you watch like the local news and there's the guy, like the weatherman pointing to the map and the map looks like a giant, you know, human organ, male, human organ.
I was wondering where you were going to go with that.
You know, you've seen that one, right?
He's going to the hand gesture place, right. And I was like, you can't do that. It's radio, kid.
Yes, right. But so a lot of the sort of the bloopers that happen on our show or on the show I used to host, Weekend All Things Considered, they never, of course, make it to the air.
Right.
Sadly, because there's an argument to be made that maybe you should. And oftentimes what happens is they're so problematic for a number of reasons that they just get cut entirely.
Well, you know, I mean, we've certainly had a few things in the vault, especially since when we first started the show, I was very picky about making sure that we didn't say anything that offended anyone, which cost both Glenn and Stephen a joke that they cared about very much that I thought I would give them a chance to explain, because I think we've matured to the point where it's okay to explain these jokes. And then you can all laugh at me for being the one who was like, I don't know if we should put it in. I'm going to let Glenn do his first.
I was going to say, yours, Glenn, was that in the first episode ever?
It was very early on. It was too hot for NPR. I basically, in passing, referred to my then boyfriend, now husband, as my trusty co-sodomite. Okay? In passing. And people were like, no. As I was saying, they're like, no, go back. You can't say. I was like, I can't. It's not my word. It's in the Bible. Can I not say fornication? There's a precedent for the use of that word. Now, granted, I'm reclaiming that word.
Right.
But yeah, I that kind of bugged me.
I know.
I'm over it now.
You held it against me ever since.
219 episodes later,
I hardly even remember it.
You held it against me ever since, and now hopefully you have it off your chest.
Yeah.
How about you, Thompson?
Yeah, mine, I don't remember the exact setting for this conversation, but I was talking about Jimmy Kimmel. And I was saying, I think Jimmy Kimmel's funny. I do find that there is a side of his persona that is a little bit too, the words I used were fratty and farty. Hmm. And I don't remember if, Linda, you kind of baited me a little bit, and we eventually got to the point where the name of my NPR morning zoo show was the Fratty and Farty Show, and that I hope post it with a name, a funny,
lovely
NPR coworker who would be my co-host. And it was really funny, but I didn't have her permission. I didn't necessarily want to go to her and say,
hey,
by the way, I said that I host a morning zoo with you called the Fratty and Farty Show, which by extension would mean that she was farty.
Right. Yeah.
and
nobody would believe she was fratty.
Right. And so it was days and days later, I wind up telling this story. One of us winds up telling this story.
It was you. Bring me into this.
It was me. I bring this joke, this concept or whatever, to Jackie Lydon, who was not the name that I had dropped on this show. And she was immediately like, oh, use me. Use me. I'll be farty. And of course, in that, like, that kind of stentorian, like, I'll be farty voice, Jackie Lydon, who is amazing, and from Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Anyway, the Fratty and Farty Show was left on the cutting room floor, breaking my heart.
Yeah. Wow. We've never done a gag reel. I am a gag reel girl. Mm. I watch a lot of gag reels. I enjoy them on YouTube. I used to enjoy them. They are one of the things I lost when I stopped buying physical DVDs.
Right.
Is that you don't get the little gag reel where they have all the little mistakes. And for some reason, that is my catnip. Particularly, I enjoy watching people make each other laugh. And it is, I can't really explain it intellectually, but I love watching people crack each other up.
Yeah. The very first one that I ever saw, I was very young. I was at some kind of convention. It wasn't a Star Trek convention, but there was Star Trek programming. And the Star Trek clip of the original series gag reel is just, you know, Spock cracking up and several shots of the doors on the Enterprise closing too soon. So they're crushing the Vulcans in their space nards, you know? I mean, that happens a lot. And everybody loved it. But it became an industry around the 80s with a show called Bloopers and Practical Jokes, hosted by Dick Clark and Egg McMahon, which is, you know, why does somebody flubbing a line? Like, some of them are funny. Like, when Tim Conway makes everybody...
Oh, my God, I was gonna bring that up.
In a series of terrible sketches on the Carol Burnett show, the Eunice, which became Eunice Mama's Family, those sketches were always death. But there's this one moment where Tim Conway is telling a story, and he can see that he's about to get everybody to break, and he just goes on and on and on with it about these two elephants and how they are joined at the trunk. And
that.
It goes on like that.
God.
And it's just this symphonic piece that
builds. At one point,
he
does the sound effect of the elephants trying to pull apart, and it's so funny.
And Vicki Lawrence is a pro. Vicki Lawrence keeps it together. Nobody else does.
Yeah.
But so that I understand. But these things when somebody just flubs a line, which is what they would do, and they would always be like an NBC show on Bloopers and Practical Jokes, like I bet things get kind of crazy on the set of Manimal. And you say, well, yes, they do, Dick. And then they show a clip of somebody. And then it's just, it was manufactured humor. It was too big. But the credit sequence of Cannonball Run, after that, it's just a gag reel where, you know, somebody says to Dean Martin, I'll shove those bleeds of yours up your nose.
I would take those rosary bleeds and stuff them up your nose.
These bleeds?
Those bleeds, yeah.
You gonna take these?
I'd take these bleeds here.
Huge laugh. And it became like this meme back in 1980, whatever, where people were repeating that line.
These
out
bleeds?
Of this entire film.
Yeah, they do the end of Bring It On is like that. The cheerleading movie has,
right,
the,
absolutely.
Has that same thing.
So the reason why we love it is because you can find the key in the fact that there was a show called Bloopers and Practical Jokes, because both of those things show somebody being unguarded.
Right.
Yeah.
It's authenticity. It's heavily mediated authenticity, but that's what we're looking for. That's what we're responding to.
I think anytime you have a notion of what somebody is like, you feel like a little thing like that. All of a sudden, you're getting a hint, like, yes, no. In the mid-80s, when I was a teenager, I was a huge fan of Moonlighting, right? Which everyone knows about me because that's how I learned to talk the way I talk. I was very into this show, but even then, there was all this business about, like, they don't like each other, like, in, you know, the actors. They don't like each other. They fight. They both had different reputations for being difficult in different ways at different times. There was an episode where, over the credits, they ran a bunch of little foul-ups and stuff like that. My favorite one is the simplest one in the entire thing, which is he is sitting on her desk, on her side of her desk, talking to her and kind of looking down at her. And it's one of these scenes where, of course, you know, that they always did, where he's trying to talk her into some crazy thing he wants to do. And she's objecting, and he sort of says, ho, 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 ho.
Ho, 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 ho.
But there's one where he says, ho, 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 ho. And he puts his hand up, and then instead of laughing or anything like that, he starts to laugh, but he leans forward down like he's going to kiss her, and she sort of laughs and leans back and kind of smacks him, and it's very affectionate, and you get the sense of, like, in that moment, at that time, at least at that place in the show, there's some affection in that relationship because of the way that he just kind of he just has that grin and he leans over like, yeah. It's those little tiny things where you feel like I'm getting a sense of something.
Yeah. Casey Kasem has a famous outtake.
I was just about to talk about it.
Okay, well,
you hit it.
It's an outtake from America's Top 40 where he's coming back from a long-distance dedication and he has to talk about a dog passing away.
This is a god last time I want somebody to use his brain to not come out of a record that is that's up tempo, and I got to talk about a dog dying.
And he lays into his producer in a huge, long tirade, kind of like Thompson does every week to our
right. Jessica Reedy lives in terror.
Exactly. Yeah. And it goes on and on and on. And it was set to music by a band called Negative Land, which is how I first heard it. Mm-hmm. And they got sued. And so you could only find it underground. But that's the reason it lasts is because Casey Kasem, everything about that guy was shellacked. Yeah. His voice, his mm-hmm. affect, his persona. It was perfect as hair. Perfect. And this was a thing of just pure animal rage. Just coming out of nowhere.
And, and that happens with lots and lots and lots of people, with Casey Kasem, with Christian Bale. And you get those little things of like, wow, really angry dude at work. You know what I mean?
Paul Anka is a powder keg, apparently, because there's this other long quota where he's just reaming out his band by saying, you know, the guys get shirts. I'm going to slice you like a hammer, which is not a thing that I have to do.
Slice you like a hammer?
Yeah, slice you like a hammer, yeah.
Wow. I wasn't familiar with that one.
Uh-huh. I think with all of this stuff, it's a humanizing element. It might be a dehumanizing element, but anytime you feel like you're piercing the veil, anytime you're getting this kind of like look behind the curtain, it's a little bit intoxicating.
Yeah.
I agree that I'd much rather be surprised with them than just watching people flub their lines, which I'm so familiar with flubbing lines, you know, in my own life that I don't need to see it on TV.
I mean, a lot of ones that you would get from us would be like, you know, me coughing or right. or just being unable to speak a sentence correctly. I don't usually screw up like the intro, but occasionally I do.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Occasionally just what comes out is not, or I'll stop at the end and I'll stop in the middle of it and say, what's a thing that I say every week that I've been doing that I've done 200 and some times?
Yeah, probably my biggest outtake would be like, how about you, Thompson?
Yeah.
agonizing silence.
Those are some of my, I think in some ways those are some of our weirdest, most embarrassing ones are things where nothing happens where all of a sudden, because it is kind of this crosstalky environment, you might have noticed. And then every once in a while it just grinds to a halt and no one talks. And it's this horrible moment of like,
Recently, just because of what we were talking over each other, Jessica needed to get Thompson saying to each of us.
Oh, that's when I was hosting.
Yes, when he was hosting. Thompson saying to each of us something like, she said. Say something like, what do you think, Glenn? He proceeded to say like an automaton. What do you think, Glenn? What do you think, Gene? What do you think, Kat? It was like this, this machine.
Kat, what do you think? Glenn, what do you think? Gene, what do you think? Those sound terrible back to back. Oh my god, I've never sounded worse.
I would not go that far.
I've certainly sounded worse, but it was so smarmy. I hope they sound less smarmy when divorced from each other.
Well, that is probably about as many little tales from out of school, including in our own studio, as we have time for. But that brings us to our final segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week, sir?
Occasionally on the show, I will talk about how much I love purging, how much I love going to the dump, how much I love donating things to Goodwill.
I do love the dump.
And I'm coming up on, this is a little bit of a Zaxxon rule, don't tell personal stories, but I'm coming up on the 10th anniversary of my departure from The Onion. And I recently packed up 3 gigantic boxes and shipped all my old copies of The Onion to the Wisconsin State Historical Society for a collection that they are putting together on campus humor publications. And suddenly, like, all these mouse-eaten issues of The Onion that I had been storing for years and years, I just let go of this massive piece of my past and shipped it off where it will be put to good use. I was certainly looking forward to seeing whatever exhibition they put together. The other thing, this episode is coming out the day after Thanksgiving, and by the time you hear it, I will have enjoyed 2 massive Thanksgiving meals, one of them being put together this weekend with the help of my son, who has been mainlining 11 seasons of Top Chef thanks to the magic of Hulu Plus. And I have been reliving the olden days of Top Chef, hating Marcel anew with the aid of my children. I'm fairly new to the whole Netflix Hulu verse, but it's been wonderful to just go back and power through these old things.
Wonderful. Thank you, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Podcasts where a bunch of people make fun of bad movies are thick on the ground. They are so thick as to be mistaken for lawn. Lots of them. So they've all developed their partisans. And come down, I'm here to tell you, I'm a partisan for one such podcast called The Flophouse.
Mm-hmm.
It's Elliot Kalin, Dan McCoy, Stuart Wellington. Kalin and McCoy are Daily Show writers. I'm not sure what Wellington's deal is. Heir to the Beef Wellington fortune. Who knows? I don't know. But the reason I've been listening to the show for a long time, but I've always only listened to episodes where I've seen the movie, right? A lot of these movies that they're talking about are really, really obscure. So I haven't listened to most of it. I never made that connection where I think these guys are funny, smart, and witty. I like that the context they're bringing to their discussions is far deeper and broader. They have a wider knowledge of film than a lot of the sort of comedy-oriented podcasts. Although they are hugely funny and they are comedy writers, they come at it with a defining aesthetic and they can argue their points well. It's very, very funny. It's very quick. And it just never occurred to me that, okay, I could probably listen to this episode that I've never seen the movie. I did. I tried it. It's a revelation. It's still funny. It's still great. It made me want to see some of these terrible movies that I haven't seen. So a huge recommendation for The Flophouse.
Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Guy Raz, what is making you happy this week?
So a lot of my friends seem to be doing Kickstarters lately. A lot of Kickstarters, right? And so I saw something on the Kickstarter page recently, which was a link to the Museum of Modern Art in New York that has a Kickstarter page, and it's basically all the stuff that was funded on Kickstarter they sell in the shop. So there's some really, really cool stuff. There's like a table lamp that looks like an open book. There's a wooden watch. There's this really cool bike light. I bike to work every day, so there's this bike light. It's got a laser beam that projects a bike on the street in front of you that you can buy at the shop. Most importantly, which has brought incredible joy to my family, are these colored pencils that are rainbow colored pencils. Mm-hmm. And then you just sharpen them and you've got this beautiful rainbow colored pencil, you know, just rainbow colors in the pencil right
there.
That's
so cool.
Yeah.
So you are, you have found some Museum of Modern Art / Kickstarter crossover material.
It's awesome.
That is fantastic. Thank you very much, Guy Raz. Well, as I was talking to Guy earlier this week, one of the things that we talked about was sort of this business, to come back full circle, this business of dropping out of pop culture. And he was kind of saying, like, what's out there that's like positive and fun and it isn't like,
dying.
He's not looking for like big disasters and all that stuff. I'm not going to promise that it has no dying because it's kind of soap opera-ish. But the thing that I am absolutely loving right now is Jane the Virgin on the CW, which is done in the style of a telenovela. And it stars a really fantastically charismatic, terrific young actress named Gina Rodriguez. And the premise, as I said, inspired by a telenovela, the premise is that this young woman who is a virgin but has a very serious boyfriend goes to the gynecologist and there's a wacky mix-up and she winds up artificially inseminated at the gynecologist. So now you have the pregnant virgin and, of course, there's the couple where the woman was supposed to be inseminated. And so she's now pregnant with that guy's biological baby and she's got her boyfriend and then there's her mom and she's got a whole backstory of her own family. It does have a murder mystery eventually. Hmm. It does have a murder mystery eventually. But it is an incredibly warm, sweet. What I said about this show to somebody recently is that it knows itself incredibly well. It's hugely confident because it's very stylized. It has a narrator who talks about what is happening in these kind of deep tones. And there's even a little typewriter that will type on the screen important words. And they kind of use it to make little visual jokes. And it's very, very sure-footed. They know exactly what they want that show to be like. And you'll know if you watch one of them, this is my speed or this isn't my speed. But for people whose speed that is, it's a really warm, really lovely family show that kind of is both wacky and really warm, which is something that I value a lot. So Jane the Virgin on the CW. So that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon, WELDON. I'm thinking you can follow Guy Raz on Twitter. Where would they follow you on Twitter, Guy?
At Guy Raz.
At Guy Raz. Who knew?
You had to beat up all the other Guy Raz.
I did, yes.
You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy. That's REEDY. You can follow our producer, Nick Fountain, at Nick Fountain. Nick like Nick, Fountain like Fountain. And you can follow our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Guy. And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. How do people solve impossible problems? Extending our senses by going beyond them, meet the next greatest generation. The TED Radio Hour is a journey through fascinating ideas, astonishing inventions, fresh approaches to old problems, and new ways to think and create. Find the TED Radio Hour on iTunes under Podcasts.